Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Joe Moore. On today's program, fights over development, tribal gaming, and high-speed rail all call Madera County ground zero. We'll talk with the newest member of the County Board of Supervisors, Manuel Navarez, and get his insights on those issues and more. We'll also talk with Sasha Coca of KQED and learn more about what farmers and farm workers are doing to reduce sexual violence in the fields. We'll also hear the inspiring story of Fashion, a young Fresno musician who is gaining international fame and stardom, gracing magazine covers and playing to packed stadiums across the globe. His music is hip-hop with a message, and his story is one you won't want to miss. But first, we turn our attention to the world of healthcare with our cover story today. While insurance companies stand to gain millions of new customers next year under the Affordable Care Act, one area of healthcare is taking a step away from the industry. Private medicine, commonly known as concierge care, but is a small but growing field. Pauline Bartolone has more from Sacramento.
The N1 Health Center for Functional Medicine sits in an average-looking corporate business park, but there's nothing average about the doctor's office inside.
Cute me getting into this little thing.
Patients check in at a marble countertop and can sip hot tea in the waiting room. They'll see one of the two private physicians here. Patients pay an annual membership of $2,400 for this concierge care.
I called today to get an appointment, thinking I wouldn't get it for a couple days, and I'm in today.
Darren Stafford wants to get checked for an ear infection before he goes on a flight. His annual membership fee also buys unlimited access to his doctor through phone or email. And he wants to maintain that timely access as the traditional healthcare system undergoes fundamental changes next year.
I wouldn't want to be in a position where I can't get that. So I think now more than ever, I feel more comfortable spending the money than I would have a few years ago.
Convenience is not the only thing patients buy here. They get more time with their doctor, too. Yearly preventive exams include high-tech skin cancer scans and ultrasounds to measure cardiovascular risks. Patients also have access to a health coach. Marcus Gomez leaves his visit today with a bag of vitamins and a folder of personal health information.
This is a little bit more thorough. You ask more questions, you get better answers.
Gomez pays the yearly fee in addition to his health insurance. His physician, Dr. Christine Burke, says that pays her to uncover patterns that might lead to illness so that disease can be prevented.
So rather than waiting until disease develops and then diagnosing that disease and managing it from that point forward, we try to look for the earlier evidence of what may cause something to go wrong.
Dr. Burke practiced traditional medicine for over a decade. She was responsible for thousands of patients. Now she's responsible for about 200.
Visits were short and the volume was high. That is how medicine is practiced these days. And I just became increasingly dissatisfied with what I felt like I could do for my patients in that limited amount of time.
All right. So we're going to go over your health asset management plan.
Burke says she used to see 22 patients a day. Now she sees 6 to 8 patients in the same amount of time.
Comes down here. So about a third of where your risk is coming in.
Burke says private medicine is not just for wealthy people. She says her patients pay more because they see health as an investment. She says her practice is an alternative to a trend in mainstream healthcare that cuts costs at the expense of individual health.
We are not all the same, and treatment should not be applied to us uniformly as if we were all identical clones of one another.
Dr. Burke says patients come to her for many reasons. Some are looking for optimal health. Others have complicated conditions that other doctors have not been able to solve. The American Academy of Private Physicians says there are about 5,500 private doctors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing.
People, in an effort to seek out physicians that are more health creators than simply body repair shops, are finding their way into the care of private physicians.
Tom Blue of the Academy says the private physician movement started in the mid-1990s. The type of care varies, but the direct payment between doctor and patient is what defines it.
You know, insurance companies can't pay for everything for everybody, but we have left it to the discretion of the payers to decide the degree of prevention that people are able to consume, unless they want to step outside the system and decide for themselves.
Blue says under the federal health care overhaul, more people may try to seek out a private doctor. Burke says it's possible fewer people might have access to doctors like her if costs get in the way. In either scenario, the people paying for concierge care are the ones who can afford it. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
Here to tell us more about private medicine in the San Joaquin Valley, we have a special guest in our studio, Dr. Karen Hansen-Smith of Hansen-Smith Family Medicine. Dr. Hansen-Smith, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. Nice to be here.
We've heard these terms thrown out, private medicine, concierge care. What do those mean to you? What exactly do you do in your practice that's different than in a traditional group practice?
Well, similar to the story that you just heard, patients pay a membership fee to be a part of a smaller group of patients over whom I can then take very good care instead of being herded through like cattle in the traditional medical practices today.
Now, how long have you been doing this? I understand before you were in this current practice, you were in a more traditional approach to medicine.
Right. I was in group practices for about 10 years, and I've been in this style of practice coming up on 8 years.
How has it changed? How has it grown over the past 8 years?
Well, I was the first one in Fresno to switch over to this type of practice. And since I moved to this type of practice, there are at least 5 or 6 other doctors that are doing a similar practice. There is a large conglomerate called MDVIP that I approached when I was first looking at going into this practice. And at that time, they didn't think Fresno was much of a market. I think I proved that there was a market. So some of the other physicians that are in this style of practice are with MDVIP.
There is a perception that maybe this is only for people with substantial incomes, things like that. Who are your patients in the broadest sense?
I have a wide range of patients. The typical people who come to family practice doctors sort of have a few children, mostly women in their 20s to 60s. I have some more geriatric patients as far as age goes. For financial income, I have teachers, I have people who are self-employed, I have people who have insurance, I have people who don't have insurance, all the way to farmers and other entrepreneurial business people. So it's a very wide range of financial groupings.
Why did you make the change?
When I decided to become a physician in the first place, it was when I was in college and was searching for what I wanted to do. I had an uncomfortable medical experience that I thought could have been handled better, and the light bulb went over my head. I could do better than that. And in deciding to become a doctor, I wanted to be able to explain to people what was going on with their bodies, spend the time with them that was needed to listen to them, to determine what was going on, and to have them help in the decision-making as to how they were going to be treated. And in the traditional type of medical practice, 20 years ago, I could see 20 patients in a day and still make my overhead and have a good take-home pay. That number started creeping higher and higher, and by the time I finished my group practicing, it was 35 patients a day. So the amount of time that I could spend with people was shorter and shorter. I ended up putting off my paperwork, things like that, until after hours. And so I would be at the office until 10 o'clock at night, and my husband would call me wondering when I was coming home, and he'd wake me up because I'd fallen asleep at my desk. My children hardly saw me, and that combination of things really wore me down. So I felt that I could either change the style of practice altogether, either becoming the kind of doctor that could see a patient for 2 minutes with my hand on the door, here's a prescription, out I go. I could quit practice altogether, or I could switch the paradigm so that I could actually practice the way that I had always intended to practice, and that's what I did.
And how many patients do you see a day now?
Typically, there are a few days where I might not see anyone, but typically it's at least 3 to 8 a day.
How has the changing healthcare world, we're about to embark on a major change, it's already underway, but with the expansion of care under the Affordable Care Act coming in January, has that had any change on your world in your market?
It hasn't yet. I do have a number of patients who are uninsured. My concern is that as they are needing to buy insurance, they might not be able to afford both me and the insurance. One of the things that I do, though, in my practice, partly because I was the first one to do it here in Fresno, trying to show people that it was economically viable, is I don't bill the insurance company. So when a patient comes in, they don't have to pay a copay. They don't have to pay a deductible. So they can find an insurance that has a really high copay or a really high deductible, and they can still see me for no extra cost. Most of the other doctors in town, all of the other doctors in town, I believe, also bill the insurance on top of what they charge the retainer for the patient.
The business aspect of being a physician is something that's often overlooked. They don't necessarily teach that in medical school.
They don't at all teach that in medical school.
What's that been like being an entrepreneur in a unique sense with what you're doing right now than what you were doing before as a physician in group practice?
Well, thank goodness for the internet and for people that are willing to help out with business advice. With group practices, I wasn't always able to figure out how much I was going to get paid based on the number of patients that I saw. The administrative overhead was quite large, sometimes up to 65% of what I billed. And my income depended on what other doctors in the practice were doing or not doing as well. And now I have a very steady stream of income and can plan on having a certain amount of money. I'm not having to borrow money to be able to cover payroll or overhead, that sort of thing, because it's a guaranteed amount of money for me to be able to just run the practice.
You mentioned why you made this choice to go in this different direction, and the piece talked about these things as well. But what do you hear from your patients as far as why they made the choice to Dr. Hanson-Smith rather than someone else?
Similar to what Dr. Burke said, I have patients who either need fairly rapid access so that they might need to be seen that day or the next day. They can't wait 3 weeks to come in to be seen. There are also people that need to spend more time, people that have more complicated conditions that in the traditional practice sense don't feel heard, that they might have more than one issue. They might have 10 issues to go over, that I might need to spend an hour or two with them going over all of their concerns. If I had 20 patients in the waiting room backing up, I would feel pressured to cut them off at their top one or two things. The problem is that when people go into a doctor, even if they have a list of things, it tends to be the very last thing on their list that's the most important to them. And if you only let them deal with the first two or three things on the list, they're not going to get to the heart pain they're having or the lesion on their skin that they think might be cancer, because those things scare them. They feel they have to work up to that. If they're not given enough time, they won't get to that point.
Dr. Karen Hanson-Smith of Hanson-Smith Family Medicine in Fresno, a private physician in the San Joaquin Valley. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Joe. Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. The problem of sexual harassment and assault extends across society. But in the shadows, the problem is even more dramatic, especially for farm workers, many of whom are in the country illegally. A new reporting project from KQED, the Center for Investigative Reporting, Frontline, and Univision aims to shed light on this issue. In our next story, Sasha Coca of KQED's California Report introduces us to one of the few California farm workers to testify against an alleged rapist in a criminal trial. Note, this story contains graphic language.
It started with a missing paycheck. Back in 2006, Guadalupe Chavez was supposed to earn $245 for a week of picking pomegranates, money the widowed mother of two needed to pay her bills. When she went to track down the check, a supervisor she'd never met before told her someone had it out in the fields. He told her to follow him there in her car. This is how she recounts what happened next.
So I followed him to parts of the field I didn't recognize. It's so easy to get lost out there.
She says he stopped in an isolated pistachio orchard, got out of his truck, approached her vehicle, and demanded her underpants in exchange for her paycheck.
He said, I'm the supervisor. I'm in charge here. And I remember that he had told me that he had a gun in the truck. And so when he had said that, and he banged hard on the car with his hand, I thought, he's serious. If I don't do what he says, he can kill me.
Then Chavez says the supervisor reached through her car window and raped her with his fingers.
Entonces yo sabía que él me estaba penetrando sus dedos en mis partes y me lastimaba.
It was hurting me. Imagine his fingers were all dirty with pesticides. I wanted for him to stop and hope that it was all he wanted. I thought, if he kills me, who will take care of my children?
After those long, frightening moments, he finally gave her the check. But then, she says, he demanded oral sex from her before letting her go.
All I remember is that I drove out of there really fast, too fast, because I wanted to get away.
2 days later, Chavez went to a rural legal aid office in Fresno about another missing check. Lawyers there said she seemed distraught, and they gently encouraged her in Spanish to tell them what was wrong. Finally, she broke into tears and described the rape. The attorneys urged her to go to the hospital, and she gave them the okay to call the police.
Oh, absolutely, I believed her. Her story was consistent.
Chris Zuniga, then of the Kings County Sheriff's Department, investigated Chavez's case.
I'm going to send you incident 169 to speak with officer.
He's now a sergeant with the police department in Avenal, a tiny rural town southwest of Fresno. As a former farm worker himself, he says he understands why more undocumented women like Chavez don't call the police.
For one, they are afraid that they're going to get deported. Number two, word gets around to the other bosses in the valley that are also doing farm labor work. They'll never work out there again.
And he says most farm worker women don't get a rape exam.
And a week goes by, 2 weeks goes by, 3 weeks goes by, you've lost that physical evidence. So now you're down to a he said, she said. And those are tough, tough to prosecute.
The first stop for a victim isn't often the police station. It's more likely a place like Westside Family Preservation Services, a tiny domestic violence agency tucked into a rundown strip mall in the rural town of Huron. There's a constant stream of women walking in after work in the fields, pulling down the brightly colored bandanas that protect their faces. Caseworker Amparo Yebra says sometimes they'll confide to her about sexual harassment or violence in the fields.
It's going to take some time. They have to feel comfortable. They have to feel like they can trust that they're going to be helped.
Yebra says she literally holds a woman's hand and walks with her into the police station to file a report. But sometimes, she says, victims change their minds once they find out what's involved in a criminal case.
Because of all the questions that they have to go over and over and over about your story. Then they send her to another person, and then she has to again talk about the story. Now she has to go to court and again testify against the story. That's very painful.
Even when women do persevere, the odds are long. District attorneys have to decide there's enough evidence to prosecute and prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
If the defense is she consented, those cases are very, very difficult. It's a credibility match, basically.
That's Kathy Ciafini, assistant district attorney for Kings County. She decided there was strong enough evidence to prosecute in Guadalupe Chavez's case. At the time, Ciafini was the county's sexual assault prosecutor. But this was her first farm worker case, and she says the language barrier can be a big hurdle for the jury.
If they're hearing the victim's story in their own language, I think it's easier for them to understand. If they're hearing it through an interpreter, jurors can't make that connection with the victim.
It's hard to say whether that played a role in the outcome of Guadalupe Chavez's case. The man she accused admitted sexual contact, but argued it was consensual, and the jury acquitted him.
Valió la pena, y lo volvería a hacer. Lo volvería a hacer. No le hace que no haya ganado, no le hace que no.
But even so, Chavez says she feels like she got some justice because the man she accused of raping her had to face her in court.
Hubo justicia, o sea, así se enfrentó a la justicia la persona.
For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Fresno.
This series was reported in collaboration with the Center for Investigative Reporting and the UC Berkeley Investigative Reporting Program. It's part of a larger project with Frontline and Univision, and Sasha Coca of KQED joins us now on Valley Edition. Sasha, welcome.
Thanks, Joe.
This series of stories that's been on the air both on now on our program and the California Report is really fascinating. I understand that farm worker women throughout the Valley now are starting to take this matter into their own hands and go through some training on this issue.
You know, we're really starting to see more attention to the problem of sexual harassment in the fields, ranging from unwanted attention, unwanted touching, all the way to assault and rape. And it's a really hard issue for women to tackle, even at the grassroots level, among some of the farm worker advocacy groups and farm worker led groups that we have here in the Valley. But one of the stories that we featured in the series is about Campesinas Unidas del Valle de San Joaquin, United Farm Workers of the San Joaquin Valley based in Tulare. And they are actually really making an effort in their meetings where they may be talking about other things like pesticide safety or how to prevent heat exhaustion to bring up the topic of sexual harassment and to create a safe space where women can talk about the fact that supervisors may be pressuring them for sexual favors or engaging in even more egregious conduct.
Do we have any idea of how widespread this problem is? I understand there have been some studies, but the numbers are a little iffy.
That's right. It's really hard to quantify. I mean, it's really hard to quantify for any population how big the problem of sexual harassment and assault is, because women face so many barriers, victims in general face so many barriers to reporting this kind of thing. And when you add on the fact that farm worker women are in large part undocumented, maybe non-English speaking, maybe afraid of retaliation, there are just so many hurdles to reporting. We do have one study out of UC Santa Cruz where a professor spent some time here in the Valley and interviewed a very small population, sample size of about 150 women, and found that approximately 4 out of 10 had reported some kind of unwanted sexual harassment or assault.
It's been said sexual assault is a crime of power, and those lacking power in this case are a good majority of them undocumented immigrants. Immigration reform is talked about right now as a major issue. The Senate's passed its bill. The House is perhaps not going to take up this issue. Does this change anything? If we have legal residency status, will more farm worker women be willing to come forward, or is this going to continue to be a problem?
I think that's the hope of advocates who are trying to bring attention to this issue of farm worker sexual harassment. And I think it's also the hope of growers. I mean, no one in the farm industry wants this to be happening on their farm. But you're right, the power dynamics that exist in terms of the fact that supervisors can be out in very isolated areas with their crews, that they control whether or not an immigrant gets a paycheck, or if her family eats, or if she can get a job when the crew moves to the next part of the harvest. That is a very, very intense power dynamic, and it's amplified by the fact that women who are working in the fields can be undocumented and then not have the security to know that they can get a job easily somewhere else. And so I think the hope with immigration reform is, number one, that if these farm workers have legal status, they will feel more comfortable reporting these crimes, even though at this point, as it stands, no matter what a person's legal status is, they have the right to contact the police. They have the right to report an assault. Many women do not come forward because of rumors that the police, you know, are working with immigration enforcement or because they're scared of deportation. One of the elements of the Senate immigration bill is that it would expand U visas, which are a special kind of visa available to people who have been victims of crime who are assisting law enforcement with investigations. And so the hope is that women who've experienced domestic violence or sexual harassment or assault, like farm worker women, would be able to access more of those visas.
What are growers doing on their own to try to address this issue?
You know, California has a unique law which says that any business with over 50 employees has to provide a certain amount of sexual harassment training. I think it's 2 hours every 2 years. And so farms are also subject to that rule. And basically, we have seen an effort, particularly by some of the larger growers here in the Valley, to really ensure that this kind of training is taking place. I visited a training put on by AgSafe, which is an organization that does general workplace safety training on the farm. And it was very comprehensive, talking about this power dynamic, talking about how supervisors do oftentimes have the power to isolate workers, to threaten them, to put them in situations where they are at risk of sexual assault or harassment. And the fact that they kept emphasizing in this training, which was attended by both growers and farm supervisors, is that it is the responsibility of the grower, the very tippy top of the company, to know what his or her supervisors are doing out in the fields, just as with any other safety issue, to make sure that pesticides are being handled safely, make sure that tractors are in working order so they're not going to hurt somebody. They need to know what their supervisors are doing, and having a harasser on staff is a liability that is going to be very expensive and very difficult to deal with in the end.
Tell me a little more about how this project came about. This is rather interesting because you have commercial media, non-commercial media, radio, television, the web, with the Center for Investigative Reporting, Frontline, Univision, and KQED together. How did this come about?
Well, it's really an interesting project in that you're right. There are a lot of media involved, and the tentacles are kind of out there in a lot of different venues. So the Frontline film is something that aired in English and was obviously designed to raise attention to this issue for English-speaking audiences. And then the translation went on to Univision, which is the Spanish-speaking network, so that both farm worker communities, Spanish-speaking communities, and people who maybe are just consumers of the food these folks pick can get a sense of the scope of the problem. And Frontline and the Center for Investigative Reporting actually spent a year crisscrossing the country and finding women that this had happened to, talking to people that were allegedly perpetrators, I mean, doing some really serious digging. And I had been covering this issue here in the Valley back since 2006 when there was a major settlement with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and an employee of Harris Farms who was allegedly raped by her then supervisor. Harris continues to say that the relationship was consensual, but the company did have a settlement with that woman. So I had been following this issue for a very long time. And as I cover farm worker issues here in the Valley, I continue to hear again and again that this is a problem in the fields. And so my goal was to take some of the digging that the Center for Investigative Reporting had done about the broader scope of the issue and focus it here in California and figure out a little bit more about the problem in our valley in the ag heartland.
Great. Well, Sasha Coca, thank you so much for joining us today. And people can find the rest of those stories online at thecaliforniareport.org.
That's right. Thanks, Joe.
I'm Ezra Romero with these news headlines. California homeowners who saw their property taxes plunge along with their home's market values during the recession could get some sticker shock when their next tax bill arrives. As Ben Adler reports from Sacramento, the bad news for homeowners is good news for state and local budgets.
This story is about a voter initiative called Proposition 8. No, not that Proposition 8. We're talking about the one passed back in 1978, just months after Prop 13 shook up California's property tax system. It allows a property's tax bill to be reduced when its market value sinks. During the recent recession, that was great news for homeowners struggling to make their mortgage payments.
Over the last 4 years, we've seen market values decline, and we've seen some of our assessments drop by as much as 50% during that time frame.
Yolo County Assessor Joel Butler.
But now as we see the market conditions starting to recover, and in some cases recovering fairly quickly as a percentage, those houses are going to come up.
And for some homeowners, this year's property tax bills could jump by 20 or 30%. On the flip side, cities, counties, and school districts will see their property tax revenues soar, bringing some welcome relief. H.D. Palmer with the Governor's Department of Finance says the state's budget will also benefit.
To the extent that you have more local property tax coming in, that means that there's less state general fund that's necessary in order to meet the constitutional guarantee for schools in any given year.
The new state budget projects property tax revenues will jump nearly 4%. That's not all from Prop 8 reassessments, but they do help quite a bit. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. From tribal gaming to regional growth and high-speed rail, Madera County has been in the news a lot lately. Here to offer his perspective on those issues and more is the newest member of the Madera County Board of Supervisors, Manuel Navarez. He was appointed to his seat in District 1 in March by Governor Brown to fill the seat left vacant when Frank Bigelow left for the State Assembly. He represents communities including the Madera Ranchos, Yosemite Lakes Park, and O'Neill's. Mr. Navarez, welcome.
Pleasure's all mine.
Madera County has been poised for big growth for decades now, being located just across the river from the city of Fresno. The area along Highway 41, known as Rio Mesa, is planned. It has been planned for decades to have as many as 200,000 new people living there within a few decades. Assuming that these developments move forward as planned, and we'll talk about them in specifics in a little bit, what would that type of development mean for Madera County, for the economy, for local government?
Well, first and foremost, if you look at the board and the makeup right now, including myself, we've always been pro-development, but also it's got to be smart development. So in other words, we got to really make sure that we're vigilant to address any impacts that happen with any sizable development. One of the first things that would be beneficial was obviously the tax dollars that would hit the bottom line. And we need more money. I mean, I think every county or government entity, including businesses, have been affected by the economy.
There have been a number of individuals, though, a lot of them call themselves smart growth advocates, that have been critical of the plans and point out they were developed decades ago before we had the focus that we have today on global warming, those sorts of things. And they call these developments sprawl. Where do you feel that they go wrong in that characterization? How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, first of all, I'm not an expert in planning and whatnot, but from what I understand it is it's not sprawl because it's planned properly. In other words, we're asking for a job balance. In other words, it's just not going to be a bedroom community. We're actually imposing that they do a one-for-one job balance. In other words, we're expecting them to develop it so people can actually shop there and work there. So it's not going to be a sprawling community. It's going to be a community unto itself.
And that brings up the discussion and the ongoing relationship between Madera County and the city of Fresno that has had its fair share of tension over the last year or so. How would you characterize the relationship with the city of Fresno right now?
Well, I mean, besides the most recent incident that happened with
there have been a number of lawsuits.
Yes, and so let's just call it what it is, the number of lawsuits. But ultimately, this is something that we feel it's necessary for our county. I don't think we hold a grudge or anything to that effect. They want to grow, we want to grow, and our job is really just to get it done and get the best deal for each one of our constituents. Now, for many years, developments have grown all the way up to our county borders, and we have really never said anything about it, even though technically they are imposing, there is wear and tear on our roads from commuters and whatnot, and that's never been addressed. So now, with them pointing out or actually going into a lawsuit type of situation, now it kind of opens up the door for us to, when developments that are like ours, but on the Fresno side, that we can address those and mitigate those accordingly.
And to give our listeners who might not be familiar with all the details of this a little more context, the city of Fresno has adopted a growth plan that intends to largely grow within the existing city boundaries. And the city of Fresno has said that it's concerned about the impacts to its existing roadways and other services by the prospect of having hundreds of thousands of new people living across the river and potentially working and commuting through the area. I've heard some people say, though, that the city of Fresno is maybe a little hypocritical, preaching about the benefits of smart growth when look at the recent past of Fresno history. How can local governments work together to manage growth a little better, in your opinion?
I think what it boils down to is money, because a lot of our local tax dollars for people would leave Madera County to come shop in Fresno. And it was really a drain on our local economy, because the pools of money that we can actually allocate to whatever we feel we need as a county come from property taxes and sales taxes. And we've been losing a lot of those taxes in the past. How do we address working forward? Well, recently when I got appointed, I had the privilege of sitting in a joint meeting with the Fresno and Madera County Board of Supervisors, which was a great meeting. There was a lot of dialogue, open communication, and it was great. I think that that can set the model of what we need to do, along with all agencies, you know, to plan and address issues that maybe both sides are concerned about before we take it to the next level in regards to lawsuits and whatnot.
And we should say there has been at least in one case a settlement, as I understand it, where there will be some money that changes hands between the developers of one of these projects and the city of Fresno to pay for some of these impacts mm-hmm. and things. One final question before we move on to other topics on development. Again, this latest project, the Gunner Ranch West development, all that area around Children's Hospital there, this is an issue that the Board of Supervisors recently, a few days ago, decided to put off for a few more weeks over concerns about water. Can you tell us your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, definitely. Matter of fact, I was one of the people that pretty much spearheaded pushing it off for the simple reason that that project is in my district. I've been out in the field. I've been really listening to my constituents, finding out. And I knew coming into the appointment that I knew water, quality and actually quantity was an issue for southeastern Madera County, which I represent. But when I actually got into office, I didn't realize how big of a problem it actually was. So this project was approved in 1994 with figures from back then. And obviously, I mean, that's almost 20 years ago, and the groundwater problems have gotten worse. We love the project. The Gunner Group does phenomenal projects. But one of the things we needed to address is water balance. What does that mean is that we're no longer going to allow products just to come to fruition with them just taking water directly out of the aquifer from the groundwater as their sole source of water, especially the fact that we are overdrafted countywide. The project's going to move forward. Nobody's really going to stop it. But we just got to make sure that groundwater problem is addressed and everybody gets taken care of.
Manuel Navarez is our guest today on Valley Edition. He is the newest member of the Madera County Board of Supervisors, appointed in March to the District 1 seat. I want to move on to some other issues
sure.
right now that are in the news, and tribal gaming is huge, and it has a huge impact on the county. Number one, the county has requested some intervention from the feds on the ongoing disputes with the Chuck Chansey Casino and the tribe there. Where does that stand right now? What role does the county play in this contentious dispute?
Well, this is a very important issue. I mean, in a perfect world, we would like to think that they could come to some sort of a conclusion and figure this out and move forward themselves. The majority of the issues that are being thrown around are really civil in our eyes, and they're a sovereign nation. So really, we necessarily don't have jurisdiction over what goes on there on a day-to-day basis, and we got to be very, very careful. What we do need to uphold is anything that's criminal. Our responsibility, as we spoke with the sheriff, is to uphold the law and make sure, you know, public safety is a top concern. And we're really making a plea to, you know, the federal level that, you know, somebody needs to step in and either, you know, mitigate this or make a decision on it, because this is something that really should not fall on us.
The governor and the state legislature recently approved plans for an off-reservation casino on Highway 99 from the North Fork Rancheria. This has been in the works for years. Mm-hmm. It is something that is a controversial issue, maybe outside of Madera. There are other organizations, other tribal governments, including the Chuck Chansey tribe, that have concerns about what this might mean. There is also a big potential benefit for Madera County. Right now, there's talk of a statewide referendum on the governor's decision to approve this casino. It remains to be seen whether that actually comes to fruition. But what would this casino mean for the county? I understand there's some revenue sharing or offsets of county services and things, some money flowing into county coffers if this moves forward. What would it mean for Madera County?
There is obviously some upside. I mean, anytime you're going to start a project of this magnitude, there's going to be jobs, which, I mean, we have a huge unemployment rate, you know, so that right off the bat is an immediate boost to our economy. And the majority of the board feels that way. We have a couple of the board, well, one of the other board members that's against the project. I'm not a tribal expert whatsoever. Right now, I've kind of been watching what's going on. I've been, you know, really not neither here or nor there. You know, a lot of people don't know, but technically when I was on the private sector, I had some major concerns about, one, the viability of the project, one, that really the numbers added up, because if you were to compare that development to a private development, the revenues are vastly superior from a private development as opposed to a tribal development. So I had some concerns. And one thing is I had only heard one portion of the argument from the Chansey side, and it was a very, very strong argument.
One final question before we go. High-speed rail, it's scheduled to break ground in just months. Mm-hmm. It's going to essentially start right here, Fresno and Madera, this first 30-something mile segment. Huge impact to the counties, huge impact to local businesses. Madera County had been a strong opponent of high-speed rail, recently backed off from some of those legal threats and things. What do you think the result is going to be, at least in the near term? And are you worried at all? There are efforts out there. Congressman Valadao is trying to advance an amendment to a bill that would essentially halt the project after this first 30-mile segment. Are you concerned about the impacts that high-speed rail may have on your community? But are you also concerned that this may be a project that might never get beyond Madera and Fresno?
Well, I don't actually feel – I feel that there's enough backing to make this project come to fruition, rightfully so. I've been a major proponent of this even prior to – I've been working on this for years. And let me clarify something. The most outspoken sector has in Madera County has been against it. But there's a lot of people that are in favor of the project, especially all the unemployed people. We have one of the highest unemployment rate. And I'm a very simple individual. It's a valuable project for the simple fact that we really only have one true industry, and it's ag. And there's nothing wrong with ag, okay? It's a great industry, but it's not an industry that creates wealth for the masses. You know, the middle class, it's either you do extremely well or you do really, you know, if you work there. I come from a field working family, and I worked in picking grapes till I was about 14 years of age. So I really knew. My parents never said, you know, look at this is a great job that you can look forward to forever. My parents were more like, if you don't go to school, you're going to do this. So it's more of a deterrent. We've set our goal as a county forever and ever to be one of the top players in ag, and we've done it, and we need to continue to maintain it. But also, to not have a diversity of economy is actually very scary, especially with the impending water issues, or some people may even say water wars. How good would it be to all of a sudden not locally figure out, which I think some of the problems with water, we can't figure out locally. We need state and federal help. But let's say, for example, nothing comes to fruition. The parties are so far on different sides. And all of a sudden, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, water is such a big issue that it starts affecting our major income industry. Then where are we at? We could have an economic collapse locally by not having any other industry. So to me, that doesn't make sense either, to have all your eggs in one basket either.
Our guest today on Valley Edition has been Manuel Nevarez. He is the newest member of the Madera County Board of Supervisors. He represents District 1. He was appointed to that seat by Governor Brown in March. Mr. Nevarez, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment with the inspiring story of a young Fresno musician named Fashawn. He's gaining international fame and stardom, gracing magazine covers and playing to packed stadiums across the globe. But it's his personal story that's really amazing and inspiring that's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. I'm Joe Moore. One of today's brightest young stars in the world of hip-hop is from Fresno. His name is Fashawn. Limitations I ain't have none. A young black kid, brainwashed by rap and rock.
VCRs. I had a Magnavox.
He's been on the cover of XXL magazine. He's toured internationally with some of the biggest MCs. And his own recordings and videos, like the critically acclaimed Boy Meets World, combine clever wordplay and rhythms with a message. Last November, he produced his own hip-hop festival in Fresno and released his latest mixtape, Champagne and Styrofoam Cups. His latest album, This Generation, is a collaboration with the legendary hip-hop artist Murs. Fashawn is also the headline artist at this Saturday's second annual Catacomb Party, a massive free music festival taking place on the Fulton Mall in downtown Fresno. Fashawn joins us now on Valley Public Radio. Welcome.
What's going on, Joe? How you feeling?
Oh, feeling great and pleased to have you with us today.
Thanks for having a youngin' like myself. Appreciate it.
I want to talk about your music and this concert that's coming up in a little bit. But before we do that, for our listeners who aren't familiar with you and your story, I want to talk about where you come from. And it really is an amazing story. You're from Fresno, grew up here. Yeah. Went to McLean High School, but your family life was a challenge.
I went to McLean High School, and I got kicked out, you know. You can go to Wikipedia that. It's like the most notable students that ever went there, and it says Santiago Leyva, you know, and but in red it says never graduated. And so I went there, then I got kicked out and went to the school called Carter G. Woodson. And that's really why I figured out that I was that, I don't know, a lot of teachers couldn't teach me, and that I was just more of a self-educated type of person. You know, I like to, you know, seek the knowledge on my own. But as far as my family life, really didn't have much of a family at all. I had my mother. Well, she gave birth to me, but she never had me. You know what I'm saying? Like, she was there not even half the time, you know. But when she was there, it was awesome. You know, she made us dinner, but she gave us a lot of affection and knowledge and wisdom. But the streets had her, and her drug addiction had her. So, and my father, he was a member of the Bulldog Gang, if you're familiar with those guys. And he's been in prison my whole life. I still, to this day, I don't know him. I know where he lives, you know. He still lives on First Street, the block I claim dearly, you know. But I had to overcome just the absence of them. I guess the freedom of having no limitations, like no one to really guide you, and really always seeking that male figure, even and that female figure. I had to go to the streets to find it, to gather all these, you know, things that I know now. You know, I didn't get to learn them inside of my household, so I was told God's favorite struggle the most, so they're obstacles, but they're like something that I feel like they were put there to strengthen me for what was to come.
Your Uncle Roy played a big part in your life. In
absolutely.
Turning things around when you were eight, you were placed in a group home.
He took us out of that, basically. He took us out of that. We went through a lot of different places, like the Marjorie Mason Center, the Craycroft Center, and just a lot of random places. But eventually, my uncle Roy wasn't having that, and he was like, I'll take my sister's kids. If no one else is going to keep them, or I'll take them. At least they'll be with some family, some blood. And he took care of me from 8 until 18, you know. And then we moved from First Street, and I had to, like, fend for myself from at that point, you know. But, yeah, that's my guy, though. That's my pops to me. You know, he's more than an uncle. That's the patriarch of my life. Yeah.
What role did music play when you were a teenager and going through those tough times? Was that something that you were always striving for? That this is a way out?
It was an outlet. It was music and skateboarding. Like skateboarding, I could physically go out and express myself, express my pain, and even just falling felt good, and getting back up and doing a trick again and landing, like, that felt good. But music was definitely I could channel, you know, my thoughts and my feelings and my emotions, like, in the music. Because I was still making it, like, from 12, 11 years old, I was still, like, writing and producing music. It might not have been the best quality, but I was still doing that. But as far as, like, listening to it and being fans of certain artists and being inspired by other people, it helped a lot. Because that was, like, the most consistent thing in my life since birth was music in my living room. You know what I mean? Whether my parents were there or not, it was always a radio blast. I'd always hear Aretha Franklin's voice or, like, Anita Baker's voice. It was, like, more than I heard my own mother's voice. So it was very influential in my life, as it is today, you know. But, yeah, it became a best friend or a mother and father when that wasn't available. That's what music was for me. It was more than just la-da-da-dee-da out the speaker, you know.
You're in the studio right now working on a new album called The Ecology. And
yes, sir.
I want to listen to the song that gives the album its name right
indeed,
now.
Indeed, indeed.
Let's listen to it a little bit.
Yeah. Underage girls having seeds at the age of 17. Baby daddy signing up for the Marines. Black streets filled with crack and pipe dreams.
Tell us about this.
It's like a journal entry. It's like me sitting on my stairs just looking out at my neighborhood, you know. And at the time, that was First and Shields Avenue. It was really messed up at the time. Really messed up at the time. Still is to this day. But I really just wanted to show what it was like to be a 20-year-old young man in Fresno, or in this world, you know what I'm saying, and stuff that we deal with and the environments and circumstances that we live in. That's what The Ecology was about. It wasn't just about the behavior, but it was about what provokes that behavior. You know, what mentality provokes these kind of behaviors, what, you know, households produce these kind of men, you know what I'm saying, that we call thugs or gangsters, you know. It was The Ecology and everything behind that.
Capital, we gotta get paid. That's the mind state that boosts the crime rate. Just lost souls trying to find their way through this puzzle, every ghetto in wider lake. Deep inside, I know it's time for a change. Wish I could reach them, but I got both feet in the grave and still sinking the environment. I drive you insane, flooded with demons.
And that's what the album is about, ultimately. You know, I took that small concept that I did for one song, and I think it applies to every aspect in life, whether you're from the ghetto, whether you're from the middle class, high class, if that even exists anymore. It's just song from the earth for the earth.
Yeah. How has your music changed?
It's just evolved with me as a person, you know? Like, I went from this, I used to like write graffiti, and I used to sell, I used to be a pharmacist and do a lot of dumb stuff, you know? But as I became an influential person and I seen my influence on kids and people, just period, That kind of changed me. It kind of helped me evolve to be more of the leader that I always said I was in my music. I really evolved, and it kind of manifested in my life. I'd always say it like, yo, I'm the general, I'm the leader, the prophet, or et cetera. But as I grew older, it kind of really manifested, and I really became more conscious of what I spat out my mouth, and even what I consumed, like with my eyes and my ears and my mouth, everything. I just became a little more conscious with time. And I guess my music is... It's synonymous with that. It's the same. It's just like, it's just me. It changes with me. It evolves with me every other year, you know, so.
If you just joined us today on Valley Public Radio, our guest is Fashawn. He has been called one of the brightest young stars in the world of hip-hop. He is from Fresno, and we're talking about his amazing life story and his rise to stardom and his newest record that's called This Generation. It's a collaboration between Fashawn and another artist, a very well-known hip-hop artist called Murs from Southern California. We're going to listen to the title track now, and I want you to tell us a little about this song.
Well, mama said she was late, still even in his absence. I had to adjust with the madness. Grew up a little quicker than your average, cause limitations I ain't had none. A young black kid, brainwashed by rap and rock. VCRs, I had a Magnavox. Back in high school, we had the campus lock.
Tell us about this song.
This Generation is a song to, I guess, fill this imaginary generational gap that's between us, you know. Like, between, like, me and Murs and my hip-hop generation and his hip-hop generation and just everyone's generation, culturally, socially, you name it. Because it really doesn't matter what year you were born or what year you died, because we all living in right now. We're all living in now. So, and that's this generation, you know. Everyone's a part of it. Whether you're old, new, black, white, yellow, or brown, it doesn't matter. That's really what the origin for the song was.
I was reading another interview that you did, and you said you want to be more than an MC. You want to do other things. You said you'd like to open a skate shop.
You said
if you weren't doing what you're doing now, you might want to be a journalist. You wrote for the paper at McLean. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I did. Why'd you read that one? I did write my research. Hey, good. I did write for McLean High School's newspaper. But yeah, if I wasn't rapping, I mean, if I wasn't Fashawn, I'd be involved in all of that, you know? Because that's just really just an extension of what I do as Fashawn, you know? like the journalistic side of what I do is, you know, me going to research these concepts, you know, actually going out and studying the topic, you know, of what I'm talking about. I think that's really the journalistic side, and how I feed it to my audience, you know, as information. It's not just entertainment, it's information as well.
You're working on a new album right now. Tell me about it.
The Ecology. I'm working on it with Exile and a few other people. We're not going to say their names. But what we did in 2009 with that album, Boy Meets World, was really special. You know what I'm saying? And I think I have a lot more to say after seeing the world. On my first album, I feel like I was a really naive kid that just had assumptions of what the world would be like, you know, on Boy Meets World. On the Ecology, it's continuing that story. This is the man now. It's more like Man Meets World.
What does Fresno mean to you, both good and bad?
Well, first of all, on the good side, it's home to me. It's where all my memories are, all my lessons, and all my wisdom comes from. It's my foundation for everything that I am now and probably everything that I will be, you know. It's a really humble place, you know. Economically, it's economically deprived, but I don't think that takes away from the richness of the people, the heart and soul of this particular city and the San Joaquin Valley. And like when people call it a farm town, I don't understand that, you know. I know I don't come from that Fresno, you know. I didn't grow up on a vineyard or a farm, you know. I grew up smelling the vineyards, you know, like on Shields Avenue. Like you can wake up early in the morning and smell the crushed grapes from the fields and stuff like that. Like, but you can look out and see graffiti and crackheads and people on a corner panhandling and stuff like that. But it's just the juxtaposition of the two, you know, it makes it beautiful to me. I love Fresno, and that's why I'm back here. You know what I'm saying? That's why you don't get that same feeling in L.A. or New York, or, you know, this is home to me.
It's part of who you are.
Yeah, it's who I am, and I feel like I'm just a reflection. I'm a reflection of that. You know, I'm a reflection of the town and everything this whole area has to offer. You know what I'm saying? And I feel like I am the voice of the area, just like yourself, sir. You know?
The Catacomb Party is coming up on Saturday. Last year, it was a big event. This year, I think even about twice as many bands performing. It's a huge event. You're headlining the
concert. I didn't even know I was headlining. That's crazy. Thanks for letting me know, Joe. I didn't know. Now I'm nervous. That was going to be a party. You know?
What's this going to be like?
It's going to be fun. It's going to be I just got like a really fun set, you know. So I heard the word party. I didn't think about performance. I thought about party. And so it's going to be a really fun set. And I think I might bring out some special guests now that I know I'm headlining. Who knows, man? It's going to be a lot of fun.
Again, our guest today on Valley Public Radio is Fashawn. People can check you out online where?
At Fashawn on Twitter. Fashawn.ca is my website. And check me out there. And mostly on Instagram, though. I really like the IG. Hit me on Instagram, The Real Fashawn.
All right, Fashawn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me, brother.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. That's all for today's program. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org and follow us on Twitter @kvpr and @Valley Edition. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero and company, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. See you next week.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.